I know the reporter's biggest question is going to be the cost of the copies. I've always felt that 8 cents a page on the federal level was relatively inexpensive compared to a dollar a page at the courthouse. Is the state system looking for something compatible to that?
I'm not entirely certain what the details of the bidding process are, but certainly they want to try and balance being able to give access to records and do it in a way that is economically feasible for users. So that's certainly one of the concerns, although I think we, like the Press Association, think access is a good thing, but we understand that access at too high a price isn't really access, so we're trying to find a way to balance that out.
That sounds good. We had several people, including Terry Gainey, who asked questions about finances and budget. Terry was specifically asking about judges and pay raises, and if you could explain that a little bit better. And also then we had a question relating to just the budget situation about court funding and the public defender program. And can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, this won't come as a surprise to anyone out there, but the budget situation in Missouri right now is not a good one. Starting with Mr. Gainey's question about judicial salaries, judges in Missouri went 7 years with no pay increase at all, starting in around 2000. And this was at a time when average state workers would get maybe 2% here, 3% there. Judges got nothing over that entire time period. And of course, inflation continued to go up and healthcare went up. So a couple of years ago, the Salary Commission in Missouri, which is actually called the Citizens Commission on Compensation for Elected Officials, it's a group of citizens who determine what compensation should be paid for the judges in Missouri, as well as legislators and the statewide elected officials. They recommended an increase for those individuals, including judges, that was equal to the amount of money that the average state worker had gotten. So that was the first raise that judges in Missouri had gotten in 7 years. Even now with that raise, Missouri's judges are paid less than the judges in the surrounding states. The Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of Missouri is paid less than a municipal judge in the city of Kansas City. Certainly the amount that the Supreme Court judges can earn is significantly lower than what an attorney with similar qualifications and experience can earn in private practice. And of course, no one going into the public sector expects to make what they can make in the private sector, but we've been seeing a number of judges in recent years leave the bench and return to private practice because of economic issues. So last fall when the Citizens Commission met, these are just random individuals. In fact, most of the individuals who were on this last commission, which was not completely constituted, were literally folks whose names were drawn out of a hat by the Secretary of State's office, randomly one for each of the 9 congressional districts in Missouri. So they were very average citizens. And they went around the state and took testimony, and most of the testimony was about judicial pay. And the issues I've already mentioned were some of the things that were included in the testimony, and at the end of the day, they made a recommendation to the legislature for what to do with salaries. And as it pertained to judges, some of you who cover trial courts probably know that in our circuit court system, we have circuit judges and associate circuit judges, but they're all trial-level judges, and there is a huge gap in their pay. It's around $12,000 right now. And in many areas, the work is very similar. So the Citizens Commission recommended a $1,500 increase per year, because the report applies to 2 fiscal years. They recommended that regardless. Then as to raises for everyone else, including the legislators and the statewide elected officials, they tied it to the legislature's ability to gauge the economy when they would be setting the budget. Because, of course, the Citizens Commission was trying to make these decisions in November of 2008, not having any idea what the economy would look like today or in May when the legislature is finalizing its budget, let alone a year from May when the legislature will be finalizing the budget for fiscal 2011. So what they said was that if the legislature believes that there is enough money in the budget to provide the average state worker with an increase, then whatever that increase is should also be applied to judges, legislators, and statewide elected officials. Of course, that means if the legislature determines that the increase should be zero, then zero is what applies to everyone else, and if they think 3% would be feasible, then that would be what would apply to everyone else. At this point in time, it's not looking like anyone is going to be able to receive any kind of a raise. And in fact, the legislature this year vetoed the recommendations of the Citizens Commission, so there won't be any increases available for judges or legislators or statewide elected officials for at least the next two fiscal years. Right now, the legislature is asking everyone in state government, not just the courts, but they're asking everyone in state government to find ways to essentially give back money out of this current fiscal year's budget, which goes through the end of June. They've asked the judiciary to come up with approximately $2.8 million. We've been able to identify a portion of that money that we believe we can go without disrupting services, but we are very concerned that if we are cut that full $2.8 million this year, then it will be in a manner that will disrupt services for the communities at large. And so it's going to be a long process. The same thing applies for the next fiscal year's budget. We're looking at about a $2.6, $2.7 million cut. So again, our people and our staff are working very hard with the individuals in the legislature to try to find ways to do this in a way that does not disrupt services for the citizens of Missouri. But obviously the legislators have some very difficult decisions to make because, as I said, this doesn't apply just to the courts. It applies across state government. So it's a difficult process.
Our listeners could actually see the impact of some of that in their local courts, correct?
Potentially they could. Other states that are in a worse position than we are right now are talking about shutting down courts certain days of the week. They're talking about only hearing certain kinds of cases, so perhaps the only kinds of criminal cases they might be able to hear are those involving dangerous, violent felonies against individuals. Some years back, after 9/11, when there was a round of fiscal problems among the state courts, one of the states quit hearing cases involving property theft, and there was an individual widely reported, I believe it was in Oregon, who actually stole five cars, and he got arrested each time, and each time he got set free because there was not sufficient funds in the prosecutor's office to prosecute him. There weren't sufficient funds in the public defender system to provide him with defense counsel, which is required by the federal constitution, and there was not sufficient time in the courts docket to be able to even hear those kinds of cases, so each time he got set free. And I know that was a difficult thing for at least car theft victims 2 through 5 to understand why this was continuing to happen, but it's a matter of just trying to make the best with what you have. And certainly we are hoping to avoid anything like that from happening in Missouri, but it's not just here, it's happening across the country, and all the court systems are trying their best to do as the best that they can with what funds the legislature is able to give them, and we certainly hope that it doesn't impact services, but it could.
It's very interesting. You're in charge of the cameras in the courtroom program for the Supreme Court, right?
Yes.
And can you talk a little bit? We had a question from Bob Miller. He wanted to know when one media outlet puts in a request for cameras in the courtroom and it's granted, what are their specific responsibilities toward other media organizations as far as the pooling goes? If those media organizations do not send a reporter to the proceeding at all but request video or photos? And then we had a similar question from Sarah West. She wanted to know, must the judge approve a voice recorder before it can be used in the courtroom? If so, how soon before a hearing or appearance must a request be made? And what about laptops for note-taking?
I'll talk about Sarah's question first, and she's from Bolivar. The cameras in the courtroom rule would specifically apply to voice recorders. Whether it applies to laptops is a little bit more dicey. However, what I tell all the reporters who make these requests in my court or who call me and talk about other courts, I think it would be wise for a reporter who wants to use a voice recorder or a laptop to go through the cameras in the courtroom process and make the request, because that way you know and you have an opportunity to talk with the judge who's presiding over the case in advance and alleviate any concerns they might have before the case comes, rather than just showing up and really needing to rely on those tools and then finding out you might not be able to use them. I've recently talked to my judges at the Supreme Court, and they are now willing to allow reporters to bring in handheld digital recorders into our courtroom and just keep them in their laps and try to record the proceedings that way. And that's been a new thing. It only recently has even been asked, and I talked to the court, and they said they're fine with it, so long as those things don't start making noises and beep when a tape's getting ready to end or something like that. Because that's part of the point of the cameras in the courtroom rule, is to try to give people access in a way that does not disrupt the process itself, because the first and foremost importance needs to be on the court process itself, whether it's a hearing or a trial or an oral argument. As to the laptop issue, I have not yet had a request for someone to bring a laptop into the Supreme Court and sit in the actual room with oral arguments and use it. We've had attorneys who've made requests to bring their laptops in because they might have parts of their argument contained in their laptop, and we've granted all of those requests. So I think that it would be something a judge would have to address on a case-by-case basis. But, for instance, my laptop makes a lot of noise, just by me clicking across the keyboard. And I think that I would probably need to find a different laptop or find a different way to type if I were to try and go into a court, because I know that if I were sitting in the back of a courtroom, my laptop would be entirely too noisy and distracting, and I'd be fearful that witnesses would be paying more attention to me and not to the lawyers asking them questions. So I advise you to talk to your media coordinator about that. Maybe try to have a meeting set up with your local presiding judge, and you know, bring the equipment with you so the judge will know exactly what he or she might be getting into, so that you can look at those kinds of issues. Going to Bob's question from Cape Girardeau about what is the responsibility for pooling, the cameras in the courtroom rule speak specifically to the fact that if you are the person who is the pool camera, so you are the only camera in the courtroom, you are the only one providing still photography in the courtroom, you have an obligation to provide your footage, your photography to people in the pool. I think that the rule is perhaps a little less specific about how that pool is defined. In the Supreme Court, I've only once had a situation where people didn't just come and all sit in the overflow room. And actually, in the Supreme Court, the fight is usually to figure out who cannot be the pool camera, because no one wants to have to sit in the actual courtroom. Everyone else wants to be in the other room. So usually the fight in my court is on who has to sit in there, and no one wants to. But I've only once had a situation arise where, after the fact, a reporter wanted to get footage from a television reporter who'd driven 3 hours to come to a hearing, and then after the fact, they asked for the footage. And I started asking some questions, and I found out that the local practice where they came from is that only one person goes, and then they just share with everyone else. And given that knowledge, and then in talking to my court instructed the person who will provide the footage to everyone else. But I think that's an issue that you all probably need to talk about on a local basis and get that work done in advance, because I think it does raise some issues. And if you ever get to a point where you feel that you're starting to have problems with this, then I'd recommend that you send a letter perhaps to Gene or perhaps collectively to the court and ask the court to consider amending its rules to more clearly define how that process works.
Well, and I certainly agree with you that if there are people out there having problems with the cameras in the courtroom rule, we'd like to hear about it. I very seldom hear of any complaints, so I'm assuming it works pretty well, but certainly if there are people having problems, I think you and I would like to know about it.
Absolutely, because a lot of times I can just try and help talk you through how I would solve the issue, and of course, I'm not the Supreme Court, I'm not my seven judges, but a lot of times I can help solve an issue. We had one time from my actual hometown where the person was taking still photos and then was providing only the shots that she wanted to the other people who were there and had already made a request to be in the pool. And I said, no. You don't get to pick and choose which photos you share with your competition. You need to give all of them. Then there became a problem because they weren't providing any information about who was in the photos. And of course, if there's only one camera photographer taking pictures in the courtroom, they're the ones who are in the best position to know who they're taking photos of. And I said, no. You need to provide that information to everyone else in the pool, because the photo is rather meaningless if the person on on the receiving end has no clue who the person is in the photo.
That's right.
Those are the kinds of questions that I'm happy to try and help answer along the way. But I do urge you all to please make your request early. It does not help if I'm getting a phone call at 2 o'clock because someone's unhappy that they are being barred from a hearing that starts in an hour and they didn't make a request in advance. Most of the courts are pretty amenable to working with you, and this goes to even trying to get copies of stuff out of the court record. Don't call an hour before deadline. Try to make that request in enough in advance that the court staff has a chance to get the file and make copies and address your request.
That's great. Let's take a break and we'll come back with some more questions in just a minute.
Thanks.
32 and growing. That's a pretty big number, especially when it comes to children's fictional stories available to your newspaper. Plus, these are serial stories, usually appearing in 8 separate chapters. A great way to encourage advertising while at the same time helping teachers and tutoring young readers. You know, potential subscribers in just a few short years. Head to mopress.com and check out the NIE Classroom Features section. It'll start your newspaper growing today.
We're back with Missouri Press Legal Hotline attorney Jean Manicky and her guest Beth Riggert, Communication Counsel for the Missouri Supreme Court.
Thanks, Don. The last question we're going to try to address today was actually a series of questions from Peg McNichol, a reporter at the Southeast Missourian. Peg had a series of questions relating to an amicus brief that the Press Association recently filed in a case in Cape Girardeau. Her questions are rather lengthy, and I think rather than address any particular question, let me talk a little about what we do in terms of amicus brief work, and then I'd like, Beth, for you to comment a little bit about the amicus situation. The Press Association frequently files amicus briefs. Amicus briefs, for those of you who aren't familiar with the term, is a brief that's filed by a party who is not a party to a lawsuit, but who wishes to express an opinion to the court and to provide additional information to the court. The term amicus is a Latin term, and it's translated as friend of the court. And so you will frequently hear that the Missouri Press Association has filed an amicus brief. In this case, we filed one in a case involving a county commissioner who sued the county commission over a sunshine law violation. And one of the questions that Peg raised was that the amicus brief was not 100% in support of one of the parties. When you file an amicus brief, you actually have to pick a side. You can't just go in and ask to file a brief without saying you support one or the other of the two sides. So in this case, the amicus was filed in support of the single county commissioner who filed the lawsuit. But because you take that position doesn't mean that your amicus actually has to follow 100% the entire argument that the party that you are filing in support of is making. In this case, the Press Association took a very narrow position. We had one very, very thin issue that we wanted to speak very strongly to the Court of Appeals on. And so while our brief was filed in support of Mr. Purcell, it was not a brief supporting him per se. It was actually a brief raising an issue to the court concerning closed meetings regarding litigation. And I know that that is a little confusing, but that's the way that the court rules set out that an amicus can be filed. We have filed a number of amicus briefs over the years. In fact, it's not been but about 6 months ago, Beth, that we filed an amicus brief in the Middleton case in the Supreme Court. So I know you're familiar that we do that. Do you see that done a lot in the Supreme Court?
You know, we have a handful of cases every year where the issues are of interest to a wide number of groups and organizations, and that's typically who files amicus briefs, friend of court briefs. What Jean just described is not at all unusual. In fact, that's the norm. When a party has issues that they want to raise with the court, they may have 10 issues that they want to raise. And those are issues that relate very specifically to them as an individual or a business or an organization. The friend of court briefs have very generalized interests in the issues in the case. And so it's not at all uncommon for a case where the appellant has 10 issues for the friend of court brief filed on that side to maybe only raise one, and maybe it's really only half of one. because their interest is very narrow. And again, as Jean described earlier, it's just an opportunity for a wide number of groups to say, hey, we have an interest in what the outcome of this case might be. And here is why we have an interest, and here is the way we would like to see the court address this situation, and here's the impact we think it will have on our members, our interests, what have you. This is a fairly common thing both in the state Supreme Court as well as the United States Supreme Court. Before we went on the air, I was talking with Jean and Don earlier about a case in the United States Supreme Court that was argued just about a week ago called Caperton versus Massey, involving generally an individual who was the CEO of a coal company, gave $3 million to a judicial candidate for the West Virginia Supreme Court. That individual ultimately was elected and then sat on the case involving whether to overturn a $50 million jury verdict against this same coal company. And the judge determined that he was able to be fair and impartial, and then he cast the deciding vote overturning the jury verdict. And he may have been absolutely right on the law. I don't know, because I haven't read that case. But the issue that went up to the United States Supreme Court was the issue of whether a judge should recuse and what standards there should be. And recuse means to say, I'm going to remove myself from this case, I'm not going to sit on this case. And there were a number of friend of court briefs filed from all sorts of organizations, everything from the American Bar Association to different organizations that look at fairness and impartiality in judicial and legal issues, to huge businesses like Walmart and Intel and PepsiCo. And interestingly, those companies filed their friend of court brief in support of the individual who wanted the judge to recuse, not on the side of the business that did not want the judge to recuse. In fact, they also had, I think this is the first time it's ever happened, the Conference of Chief Justices actually filed a friend of court brief in that case, and there were a number of former state Supreme Court judges, including one or two in Missouri, who signed on to an amicus brief as well. So it's just a way for a court to properly look at the issues raised by individuals who are not a party to a suit. And I say properly because many times at the Supreme Court we'll have people just want to write a letter and say, hey, I read about this particular case in my local newspaper, and I really feel strongly that you should decide it in this way. And that's just not, the court is not ethically permitted to consider those kinds of arguments. And the amicus process was designed so that individuals outside the litigation, who aren't, as Jean put it, actual parties to the litigation, can say, we have a legitimate interest in the outcome of this case, and it's a legitimate way for them to speak to the court. They don't get to argue in front of the court, but they do get to submit their written arguments telling the court how they would like to see the case come out.
Thanks, Beth. It's been a treat to have you here today. Would you like to remind all our listeners how they can reach you if they need to talk to you?
Absolutely. First, our website is www.courts.mo.gov, and I can actually be reached in Jefferson City at area code 573-751-3676, or by email at beth.riggert@courts.mo.gov. And I'm happy to help you in any way I can. And if I can't help you, I'm not afraid to say, I don't know the answer. Let me find someone who can help you.
Thanks for all you do for our members, Beth.
Thank you, Jean.
We want to thank Beth and Jean Manicky for being here today to share their expertise with us. We also want to thank the reporters and editors who wrote in with their questions. We want to thank Sarah West, a reporter with the Bolivar Herald Free Press, Peg McNichol, a reporter with the Southeast Missourian in Cape Girardeau, Bob Miller and the news staff at the Southeast Missourian, Kent Ford, Missouri Press Association editor, and Terry Ganey, projects editor, and Jim Robertson, managing editor, both of the Columbia Daily Tribune. You know, a valuable benefit of membership in the Missouri Press Association is our legal hotline services. Active members may contact Jean directly for advice and answers to legal issues. Jean can be reached by telephone at 816-753-9000 or by email at jmanicky@manickylaw.com. You can find all this contact information anytime on the Missouri Press Association website at www.mopress.com. The website also provides links to Jean's blog and current and back issues of the Missouri Press News Magazine, which features a monthly column by Jean. This is Dawn Kitchell, and I hope you'll join us for the next legal podcast from the Missouri Press Association.